Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. We're here in the basement of Jack Shaman Gallery. Today, my special guest is Hank Willis Thomas. Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm just ducky.
Nice.
Tell us what your website is so that the listening audience can follow along, if you would.
I have two websites. One is my website for my own personal work, which is www.hankwillisthomas.com. And then I'm also part of a collective, which is called Cause Collective. And our website is www.causecollective.com.
Sounds good. Now, just to start off with, tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Wow, who am I? I'm Hank. I'm Deb's son, and I make art. Would you like me to expound on those?
No, that's okay. Fantastic. Now, a lot of the art you make is tends to be wrapped up in what you say is explicitly about race, class, and history. Talk to me a little bit about that.
And commerce.
And commerce as well?
Well, yeah, a lot of the things that I think my work that's not about a collaboration winds up just being around the things that I think I'm most shaped by, which are history, the notion of race, class, and commerce.
Okay. Now, when you talk about race, why do you hate white people?
Wow. Well, because growing up on the Upper West Side of New York, it was really hard because, you know, it was a pretty integrated neighborhood and, you know, white people weren't always the majority. It was really hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you're making work about race, I mean, many people, you know, say that, you know, let's take, for instance, Obama being elected. You know, many of the headlines, you know, if you go with the Post on one end saying, you know, like, race politics is over. And then you go the New York Times or something like that, you know, them saying that, you know, the discussion has only begun. Like, what do you think about that?
I think they're both right. I mean, I can go on.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, I mean, about the Post thing, that was really heartbreaking and devastating and scary to see in the 21st century. But then just 1 week later, we have Obama's address to the Congress. And it was probably the most historic moment that I haven't read about, so maybe it wasn't overlooked. The most historic moment when a black man gave a white man validation, which is when Barack Obama says, I have this really boring, annoying, nitpicky job. You know what? I'm going to have Joe do it. Because I trust Joe and they're not going to mess with him. I'm going to have Joe go do my dirty work. And Joe couldn't have been more proud to have been given this terrible job. And just like this moment, I was like, did he really? I mean, Joe's turning red. Yeah, they don't mess with me. Like this amazing. So like this one time, like I'm afraid every time I see Obama on television or in public. But at the same time, it's the conversation about race as we know it has changed forever, because every day history is made. Every day they say President Obama, they don't even sound like an American president. You know,
no.
It shifts our whole understanding of who we are, how we have to be. And so that's where I say they're both right, you know.
I would agree with you on that.
Touche.
As far as what your artwork holds in relation to this, I mean, your own practice being very wrapped up in notions of race, and here at Jack Shaman you have a show up right now where you know, many of the themes are appropriated from advertising, you know, from your Timberland to Air Jordan to you know, Johnny Walker, things like that. How do you see your own art changing kind of in the wake of this election?
Well, that was the most challenging thing about the show, is that I had to make work knowing there'd be the prospect of having a black president in Black History Month, which is when my show happened to be scheduled. And it's like, okay, if McCain had won, I was just like, oh, I already got that work. You know, and if Obama wins, I have to make work that's somewhat more open-ended or perhaps slightly more hopeful. Maybe around the same content and ideas, but to try to make work that is harder to nail down about history, because it's of a time when things are a little bit, some things have to be let go and some things have to be rethought.
I was walking by McGraw-Hill today on 6th Avenue, or Avenue of the Americas, and up by Radio City Music Hall across the street is the skyscraper from McGraw-Hill. And they are...
There's a hill over there?
There, yeah, exactly. And they make the textbooks of the
world. McGraw-Hill, yeah.
Right. And often overlooked as one of the most powerful institutions in the galaxy are the people who make the things that you learn by and then go forward and espouse the rest of your life. You
know, I need to get a job there. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Tell me about it. So, you know, along the notions of who tells the history makes the history what it is.
Talk to me a little
about that. Yeah.
That's essentially it. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't the first person to say it, but Chuck D from Public Enemy said, you know, real history isn't history. It's his story. And that's kind of what is... this show was originally going to be about. I was originally going to call the show The Myth of a Black History. And it was because the whole notion of black history is a myth. And it came out of justified reasons. You know, first Negro History Week was inaugurated in the 1920s because there was not any sufficient or trustworthy kind of literature writing acknowledgement of the significant impact African Americans had had on American culture. And then there was also, then that expanded in the 60s, I believe, to Black History Month, which really tried to spend this whole month of meditation and focusing on kind of our contribution to the society. But when you think about it, our country, you know, in the 21st century context, black history is simply American history. When we say black history, we don't mean Afro-Caribbean or Afro-South American or African history or Afro-European history. We really just mean African-American history and a little bit about Africa.
Right.
And you can't find a moment where Black Americans' story was totally distilled or separate from the story of America. Our story is the story of America. And so then I was thinking maybe I could call the show American History Month because that's what it is. Yeah. But then, because, you know, Lincoln was born, president, that wasn't Washington born here, but also Frederick Douglass and W.B. Du Bois. You know, it's an important month, February.
Star-studded cast.
Yeah. My mom. My grandmother, my grandfather. So I like February. Oh. Anyway, I'm digressing.
It's my your mother fault. As well. It's don't totally, worry. It's totally don't your worry. Fault.
Anyway, where was I? So the myth of black history, then African, within American History Month. And then I realized I didn't really have enough time to do the real research and give the work enough thought to make a solid show that I could totally defend around those ideas and that articulated them and that weren't just kind of in the McGraw-Hill way, like, look, you know, the white people were part of this aspect of African-American history. Like, John Brown is a very, very important figure in black history.
Right, right.
And Barack Obama did not make black history. He actually made American history. that's the kind of issues I wanted to talk about. A sign of the time was this conversation that happened around our president, where in 2007, there was this conversation in late 2007 is like, oh, he's never going to get elected. He's not black enough. You know, Hillary Clinton, you know, and Bill Clinton, you know, black people love the Clintons. And then, you know, Jeremiah Wright came along and he quickly became too black. And then, after the whole convention, the whole conversation became about him being, you know, post-black, which was a conversation that we've been talking about in the art world for some time, but that, you know, that his blackness, it wasn't something that you could just categorize and put him in and define so easily. And that really was in theme with, I think, a show that I'm in at the Rebel Family Collection called 30 Americans, where they distinctly made the choice not to say 30 black Americans or 30 African Americans. They called it 30 Americans. And then that my book, which Aperture published, I titled Pitch Blackness, in part because I often say, you know, off whiteness, pitch blackness, coffee's the color of my skin, because the scary thing about blackness for me is that black people didn't make it up. That white people with a commercial interest in dehumanizing black people as a brand made it up. And so it can never really truly be in our service, even though we might have embraced it at some point and made black beautiful. Me and almost every other black person, I've been all over the world. I've met some really dark-skinned people, met some really light-skinned people. I've never met a white person by definition. I've never met a black person.
Albino? Come on. That is as white as it gets.
That is as white as it gets.
I grew up in Alaska. It's not,
this right here, this wall here, what color is that?
That is taupe, off-white.
But no, I'm saying white people are more closer to off-white
definitely
than they are white.
Totally.
And black people are closer to brown than they are black.
Yes, correct.
And so, but in our language, the way we speak, okay, just to clarify, this is black. This book right here, my book, that's black. Can you try to describe the difference in tone between my skin and the book?
None.
No, you couldn't. I wouldn't try either. But that's so blatantly obvious.
Right.
You know? And yet I remember my friend Biate Ross Smith, another artist and friend of mine who you know Biate, right?
Yeah.
We were like 6 or 7 years old, walking on 90th in Amsterdam in Columbus. And I was like, Biate, you know, we just finished coloring. I was like, why are we called black? You know, because, you know, the crayon.
Right.
Says brown that we are. I was like, aren't we brown? He's like, no, we're black.
You remember Crayola used to have flesh tone.
Flesh tone.
What color was flesh tone crayon?
Some black people, some Asian people, and some white people are flesh tone.
Right.
But yeah, most black people are not flesh tone.
Right.
So those were the days. And I'm like, and he had to really kind of remind me that he's like, no, your skin may be brown, but you are black.
Right.
And it really kind of, and like through like repetition of him saying that, it's like, oh, I understood that blackness was a state of mind, not, or stigmas maybe, but not necessarily something that defined me inherently. And I think 30 years later, I'm like, oh, that's true. You know, that the definition of myself as black, although I might always kind of relate to it in some way, doesn't really say anything about who I am, except for the fact that I'm a descendant of a slave,
right?
Likely.
Talk to me about ads, advertising. One of your projects, not so much that you have during this show, is called Unbranded.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that Unbranded, so I did a series called Branded before that, and that was a series of images that were graphic and photographic, and they looked like ads, and they kind of spoke to my own agenda. It was me putting my own, using the language of advertising, logos, to put my own two cents in the conversation that they started. And then someone gave me an ad and said, you should do something with this. And it was a 2001 Toyota RAV4 ad, and it was of, there's no car in it. It was just some lips of African-American or a brown skin, dark skin, African descended person. And that person was smiling, and they had a gold cap that was in the shape of a Toyota RAV4 on it. And so basically it's a black person's lips with smiling with a gold cap.
A car cap.
Yeah. And
which I don't think I've ever seen. Have you seen that?
No, I've actually not seen that. But it might be a trend. Maybe we weren't looking close enough.
Exactly.
But someone's like, you should do something with this. And I was just like, what can I do with that? And it took me a few years to figure out what I could do with it. But then I thought that by removing the logo from that image, you look at it and you have no idea what that's an ad for. Like, it literally could be an ad for anything, toothpaste, a dentist. But the last thing you're going to think is a Japanese SUV. Right. And then I started looking at other ads that focused on African Americans, and still struggled to find the actual correlation between the brand or product and the supposed kind of African American experience that they were trying to pitch with it. And so I started to do the series, and it's called Unbranded Reflections in Black by Corporate America from 1968 to 2008. And in that series, I take 82 ads, so two ads for every year from the end of the age of MLK to the dawn of the age of Obama, and removed all of the branding information, and just to look at what's being sold. So digitally, it took off all the text and the logos,
right,
and you can just see the naked truth of the image.
The visual language is.
Right.
Versus the overt message.
Right. And that product, and basically it shows that truth is better than fiction. And it's that project is kind of tries to track blackness as a corporate idea over this 40 years. And you see this perhaps evolution or devolution of the corporate understanding of kind of blackness in that period. And so I don't know how to, I didn't find any universal truths perhaps in it, but it's interesting to look at kind of this demographic. Anytime marketing is, you're marketing for a demographic, you're inherently using generalizations,
right,
to build your argument. And inherently with advertising, your generalizations, well, Roland Barthes says myth becomes naturalized through like these images where you see it enough times, it must be true, you know. Black, right, people like gold teeth. If I've seen 100 black people with gold teeth, even though I've seen 100 million without,
right,
that 100 that I've seen stuck out for me, and
right,
that means black people must like gold teeth.
Do you have gold teeth?
I made some grills called with, let's say, Black Power on them for another project, so I do have some.
So there you go.
Yeah.
It's you speak about advertising, and much of the artwork that I'm familiar with that you've done is very, I would say, very polished, very smooth, very slick in, mm-hmm, that kind of advertising fashion.
Like you.
Very. Mm-hmm. That it's very high gloss and pristine, you know, that there's that kind of that fetishization of the object that, you know, there's, you know, the Timberland Air Jordan mix upstairs is stainless steel, totally buffed out, that is perfect, like an advertising piece or like a corporate logo that, you know, on the front of adorning some bank or something like that. Tell me about kind of your fascination with that.
Why do I need to tell you if you already know? Well, I was at a sign company. I went to a sign company to do a project to make a sundial a few years ago, and then for this show, I made another piece with them. And for this show, I went back and was kind of talking to the owner, looking at stuff. And they make polo signs, and, you know, they make all the signs for the New York City subway, and like all these different, like lowbrow, all these corporate signs. And I thought that it would be interesting to use that same medium that, you know, these corporations use to make art, you know, that to kind of make the conversation about these logos, brands, or text a little bit more complicated by using, so that the same, rather than actually using ads in most of the work, I'm using the outputting methods of the marketing industry to make the work. So,
right.
That was the current theme, the theme with all of the work, almost all the work, to have this kind of, so there was neon signs and lenticular prints, and
right,
even the headstones are, that's advertising, you know,
right,
when you think about it, like a headstone is an advertisement for someone's life. It's like, this person was worth remembering.
Right.
Whereas most people who die don't have headstones, and we forget that.
Potter's Field.
Can you break it down for me?
Out on the Hart Island, out by Rikers, there's an island that they have where all the indigents and poor people are buried in New York City. And they've got almost 1 million people buried out there. That, you know, if you die in the street with no money and no relatives, they send you out there.
I've seen it in the movies.
Yeah.
Potter's Field.
Yeah.
We need to go there. Have you been there?
No, not yet.
Seems freaky.
I'm going. The people who are responsible for burying and then digging up in case somebody wants to see them are Rikers Island prisoners.
Dud.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to other things. What's that?
Nothing. I'm sorry.
Go for it.
Hmm?
The question I had for you is this. What do you consider to be your greatest failure in life?
My greatest failure in life?
Yeah.
Besides being a vegetarian?
I had 13 years in and then I buckled. It was a hot dog on the 4th of July.
I might have had 13 days. But I was a good vegetarian. my biggest failure in life. I mean, I don't know, because, you know, some people see failure, and I happen to be one of those people that sees opportunity. I'm desperately afraid, or deathly afraid, of failure ultimately. But when I do fail, it's like, oh, what a relief. Now I can figure out what I was really looking at.
Right.
So, you know, failure in life. I must be about relationships, huh? I must have failed as
Is there a love that you've had and lost?
A few. I mean, but they're still my friends, so I didn't seem to fail completely.
That's good. That's a rare thing.
Mm-hmm.
Myself being divorced, you know, and the ex and I, not particularly friendly. Wow. Although we've said hi at, you know, at when we run in. But the fact that you're friends with your exes, that's pretty big.
Thanks.
I think that speaks to your character.
I love you guys. Yeah, I mean, so yeah, trying to think about failure. I mean, a performing artist friend of mine named Kamal Sinclair, told me something that stuck with her from the first time she met me, in that I was working on a project and I was trying to fail. And she was like, she'd never met somebody who was just like working on something where like they knew they couldn't do it. And she said what was great about that and seeing me 10 years later with my work is that through that failure, it helped me to figure out what I was really trying to do or what I could do.
Right.
And so there's one series of photographs. The frame series, one of my first photo series. And I was walking around the country, going to different public events and people's houses and holding and taking pictures, holding a frame or the subject holding a frame. And so there'd be a frame within the frame.
Right.
And it was really trying to talk about the manipulation of photography and like reference what's going on outside of the frame of the camera.
Right.
And all places that influences how we see things. And ultimately, I never really figured out how to frame the pictures. And it was like...
Did you ever show them?
Yeah, I showed them. But they were just like, you know, regular black frames. But it clearly, because some of the frames were brown in the pictures, some were yellow, some were metal. Right. Some were black, but clearly, if I was really smart, I'd have thought of something,
right?
You know, and it was something about going to that place of like, I just give up. That kind of probably really helped me with my fear of to become okay with failure once it's proven itself to be the fact.
Well, it is inevitable that all people fail. I mean, I think even the Pope has had, you know, his moments, you know.
Which one?
Yeah, well, creepy one we have now. Oh. Not that other guy. He was okay.
He's okay.
Anyway, but I think, you know, the human being.
Wasn't he a Nazi?
Shh.
Oh, sorry.
You know, it was nice knowing you, Hank. Anyway, no, but that everyone is fallible. You know what I mean? So that there are mistakes throughout it. And And that definitely the thing that resonates for myself is, you know, what you do after the mistake.
Yeah. So wait, what was the point of that question?
Curiosity.
What was your biggest failure?
My biggest failure? Whew. Well, you know, there have been quite a few, so it's, you know, to sift through the rubble of them.
Yes.
But probably leaving San Francisco, the most beautiful city in America.
Boring, though.
Boring, one could say, or not.
It's
depending boring. What you're looking for.
Okay, if you're not married and don't have kids.
Right.
And don't have a decent salary.
Mm-hmm.
And a car.
You don't need a car to live there.
To get the most out of the Bay Area, you have to have a car.
Bicycle. It's like the most bicycle-friendly.
You can bike across the bridge and then sweat your butt off going up to the headlands and then nearly die going down the hill.
Sounds like you have experience in the subject.
No, I've seen it happen.
As you try to run them off the road.
But really, I mean, the thing, I miss San Francisco.
You go back, don't you?
I go, I'm somewhat bi-coastal, and what I say is that San Francisco has the best day life of any place in the United States, as far as I can recall. And New York has the best nightlife.
In America.
And I say under my breath that L.A. probably has the best of both worlds. I couldn't force myself to move there. But that's the problem. Like, after 9 o'clock at night in San Francisco...
It's grim.
It's boring.
It's grim. Yeah, I agree with you.
I don't know if grim gets... Grim is like creepy. It's just, it's not like...
Well, polk at like, you know, 2:30 in the morning is grim.
It's definitely not boring, though.
No.
So, anyway, we digressed again.
Again.
You're going to cut this part out, probably.
Hell no. This is the only part I'm keeping.
Oh, good.
Next question. Advertising. Have you ever been approached by an advertising firm?
Firm, no, but I did get hired by Puma not too long ago.
And
I did the job. It was I appropriated a Puma ad for my Unbranded series, and they liked the ad so much that they were like, hey, we want you to do a job. I was like, but I didn't take the picture. And they're like, yeah, but
we own it.
And so maybe as an alternative to suing me, they co-opted me.
That was, you know, that is the way.
That's the way. This, you can't beat the system.
No, because it just swallows you.
Yeah. So.
I hear that's what the CIA does to hackers, large-scale hackers.
Yeah. Like you're pretty good. You want to go to jail,
or
you want to?
You want to make a lot of money.
Yeah. Wow. So that's exactly that's those people are basically going for failure. The hackers.
Right.
They're basically trying to ruin somebody else's day or life.
Right.
And if they get really good at it, they fail.
Only to have their own life hacked by
exactly.
The bigger system.
By the man.
Yeah.
Barack Obama. He's the man now.
Barack Obama is the man now.
Yeah.
Who is coming down on you and raising your taxes.
He's the man.
Yeah.
And there's a piece in my show here called I Am the Man.
Yes. Let's talk about
that. Somewhat related to... Our president being the man.
The Withers photograph that you have based it off of. Tell me, for our listening audience, please give a descriptive.
Well, there's a really important civil rights photographer by the name of Ernest Withers. He died about a year or two ago. I got to meet him once before he died. And he took this very famous epic photograph of the civil rights movement where there's... over 100, maybe hundreds of black men protesting in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968, holding signs that say, I am a man. And I was born in 1976, so 8 years after that event. And it's crazy to think that 8 years before I was born, which is equivalent to 9/11 for us, that it was still necessary and important for people to make public collective statement affirming their humanity in our country. Like, that's crazy, because even in the world I grew up with, in that you know, that it was taken for granted, at least, that I'm a man.
Right.
And actually, to the degree of something that came out of a conversation with hip-hop music and hip-hop culture, which was, I'm the man. I am the man.
Right.
And so to think that in this 20 years from, like, I am a man protest to 20 years later, you have, you know, who's there? You have Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Bo Jackson and, I don't know, Mike Tyson. And, you know, you have all of these, and all these, you know, hip-hop artists, you know, I guess Eric B. and Rakim. And, you know, there's like this conversation of where black masculinity is being put forward as this kind of thing to desire. So I'm the man, you know, I'm the shit.
Originally, though, the man had a negative connotation dating back to the 60s and government.
That's the whole irony of it.
Right.
And now it's come full circle. So Barack Obama is not only the man, he's also the man.
Right.
And so that series of paintings, you know, that's is basically riffs on this idea of I'm a man. So there's 20 paintings and they have these different kind of relationships, and the bottom row of them actually kind of reads like a poem, which says something like, I am the man, you the man, who's the man, what a man, I am many, I am human, I am a man. And it's kind of like this ego trip that goes from wanting to affirm myself over top of you to maybe deferring my power to you and then wondering who's actually in control, to this kind of more holistic or general kind of accepting that I'm a part of humanity, of everything. And then just finally resting on, I'm happy that I exist. You know, I am a man, which is something that we often don't think is enough. You know, if you can say I am a man, you're doing pretty good. You know, at least that means you're not dead. And that's a great place to start. And that's kind of how I want to live my life, as hard as it may be, and hopefully it's pretty easy, you know, living with pure joy and acceptance of who I am.
Well, I think that's as good a place as any to leave it.
Or what I am.
Or not. Thank you so much, Hank. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle at www.frankprattle.com, or you might also be listening to Art International Radio at artonair.org. My special guest today has been Hank Willis Thomas. You can see his show that's up right now at Jack Shaman Gallery down on West 20th in Chelsea, and also at your website, which is hankwillis.com.
HankWillisThomas.com, or there's the book, Pitch Blackness, which was published by Aperture.
All right. Thanks so much.